The WBAI local station board will meet on Wednesday, February 8th, 7 p.m. The meeting will take place at the Theater for the New City, located at 155 First Avenue at 10th Street, and is open to the public. Take the L train to First Avenue. There will be time for public comment. An executive session will follow the meeting. Again, the WBAI local station board will meet on Wednesday, February 8th at 7 p.m. The meeting will take place at the Theater for the New City, located at 155 First Avenue at 10th Street, and is open to the public. Take the L train to First Avenue.
On Sunday, February 5th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents composer, vocalist, and arranger Lisa Fisher. Lisa Fisher was featured in the Oscar award-winning 20 Feet from Stardom. Join us as we discuss Lisa Fisher's career and her latest project with the band Grand Baton. That's Sunday, February 5th at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Fidel Castro desde Oriente a Batista combatió. Fidel Castro desde Oriente.
On Saturday, February 4th, join the New York-New Jersey Cuba Sea Committee in a New York tribute to Cuba's revolutionary leader, Fidel Castro. For everyone who admires the political and social achievements of Cuba's revolution, join in the celebration of this great world leader as we honor the leadership and vision with which Comandante Fidel and the July 26th movement guided Cuba's people and society and their solidarity, sharing the small resources with those who had less. Show some revolutionary love and join us Saturday, February 4th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Malcolm X Betty Shabazz Center, Broadway and 165th Street in Harlem. For more information, please call IFCO at 212-926-5757, extension 6.
Brush up your Shakespeare. And
they're all downtown. The WBAI University of the Air and the New York Shakespeare Reading Group will be holding a continuation of the reading of William Shakespeare's play, Richard III. The reading is open to all. Please bring a copy of the play and food and drink to share with all. It will be held on Saturday, February 11th at 12 p.m. at the Atrium, located at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. Again, all are welcome to read together out loud Shakespeare's play, Richard III, on Saturday, February 11th, 12 p.m., at the Atrium at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. Take the 2, 3, 4, or 5 train to Wall Street.
And they'll all kowtow.
I say you're my love. Listen to my speak.
Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
I'll wait for you.
I'll wait for you.
Coming after my soul, wanting to take control. Wanna give me lies, wanna give me blame, wanna give me all the material things. I hear them talking about what the world has to offer. Girl, what you doing, don't you see? What they have done to Bedward and Marcus, Jesus and all of the prophets. But I'm not afraid. Cause I'm protected by the Most High One. They don't mind when you fall behind and can't pay your bills on time. Prostituting and standing in a them government line. No, and they don't mind when you waste your time coming up with some stupid lines, influencing the youth them for snatch a line and take a life. When you're locked up in jail, can't get no bail, sentence for life. I can't see your youth and strive. No, they don't mind. But I'm not afraid. No, no, I'm not afraid. No, I'm not afraid. No, if them might come, let them come, cause I'm protected by the Most High One. Them coming after my soul, wanting to take control. Wanna give me lies, wanna give me blame, wanna give me all the material things. I hear them talking about what the world has to offer. Girl, what you doing, don't you see? What they have done to Bedward and Marcus, Jesus and all of the prophets. But I'm not afraid. Cause I'm protected by the Most High One. They don't mind when you fall behind and can't pay your bills on time. Prostituting and standing in a them government line. No, and they don't mind when you waste your time coming up with some stupid lines, influencing the youth them for snatch a line and take a life. When you're locked up in jail, can't get no bail, sentence for life. I can't see your youth and strife. No, they don't mind. But I'm not afraid. No, no, I'm not afraid. No, I'm not afraid. No, if them are
come, let them come, cause I'm protected by the Most High One.
And that was Etana, E-T-A-N-A, from her CD, The Strong One. I heard that today and I couldn't resist asking, what is that? So great that I beat. Could play it today. I love that song. I just thought it was very uplifting.
Yes.
And so you are tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, and this is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And I am Catherine Davis in studio with
Paulette Spencer
and
Matt Mazza.
Yes, indeed. We are your three musketeers of the late night, but sadly, no longer. This program will be moving to 1 p.m. on Monday afternoon. Well, I should say back to. So, folks, this is where where it is. There's going to be some program changes after the drive. And I love this time slot. I do. But it'll be nice to sleep through the night. for every once in a while, you know, that'll be nice to do. But I will kind of miss sort of this happy-go-lucky free-for-all. So that'll be interesting.
The Night Owl special.
Right. But we're still going to be here, yeah. Only in the afternoon. And I believe Health Action is being scheduled for this time slot, which is a program that I am also a co-host of with Bob Letter and Mark Henney. See what happens at this midnight hour. I will still have a presence here, along with two different co-hosts. So it'll be interesting to switch things up, see how it goes. Because, you know, this is how media works. You never know where you're going to be. So I'm just grateful to be here, as far as I'm concerned. So how was your week, Paulette? It's been a week since we've been here.
It was great. I went to a fantastic concert at the Jazz at Lincoln Center that I was boasting and mm-hmm. announcing all over the place, which was called The Latin Side of Dizzy.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
It was brilliant. And it was led by a bass player who is the bassist for the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. And he had a few of his players performing vintage Dizzy Gillespie music that was recorded back in the 1940s.
Wow.
And this was Dizzy's Latin Cuban jazz period. Mm-hmm. And so this player, his name is Carlos Enriquez, a Bronx native. Mm-hmm. He arranged some of this original music. And it was a beautiful, wonderful experience, and it featured the musician Pedrito Martinez. He was there on the congos, and with this arrangement, it included his singing. And so the house was completely full, and the room itself, the Appel Room, I would say, if you have the opportunity to go to a concert there, go, because you're sitting five stories above street level at Columbus Circle in the Time Warner building, and you're facing a giant window, so you're actually looking out onto the street during the entire concert, and it's a spectacular view, and the acoustics are wonderful.
Sounds great.
Highly recommend it.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds pretty cool. And Matt, how was your week?
Very interesting. One of the highlights was I went to the Anthology Film Archives. By the way, they are at 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street. And coming up, they have in a couple of weeks, Friday, February 17th and Saturday, February 18th, Leonard Cohen, some films about him. That looks interesting. But I saw last week a program with a filmmaker present, question and answer afterwards, on the Incas, mountain music of Peru. And this showed how they live 12,000 feet above sea level. One of them was in Lake Titicaca, which is the top of the mountain, 12,500 feet above sea level. How they make bricks out of mud and clay, and they use reeds for almost everything. They can make mats out of it. They make tools out of it. It's very interesting, the resourcefulness of these people. They can make boats out of it. That was quite interesting. And then there was Carnival in Keros, where you have playing music and how they live on alpacas, their economy based on alpacas. And it was showing the difficulties that these people were having as they purchased these alpacas from a broker, and they were too old to reproduce. And they took a bank loan to do it. Even at 12,000 feet above sea levels, you can't get away from these blokes. But it shows how they live, how they managed, and they got some more money. The filmmaker, John Cohn, had given some of his own money to buy a bunch more of the alpacas. And they made an agreement. One part of the community was going to keep them in the beginning, and they signed the document. After a certain period of time, they were going to, after they increased the number, they were going to distribute them throughout the community. And the first community kept them for themselves. So it shows to go you, goes to show you. But it's very interesting how they sing, just like we have the blues. They have their own form of music where they're singing their travails. One person's child died and they were singing what happened. Very interesting. And so they still go. You could still donate money to them. Find the Caros on a website of some sort. But that was very interesting.
Do you have the website?
I think Caros.com, I think. You could try that.
How do you spell that?
Caros. Q'Eros. And there was a carnival that was taking place at the time.
Well, that's beautiful. Well, I'm beginning to realize that I am just not having as much fun as I should be having, because you guys are doing all this interesting, cool stuff, and I basically go from one work site to the other with a lot of sleep in between, I guess. So I don't have anything quite so fascinating to
you can
about.
You can always have tea at Cafe Reggio on McDougal Street.
Oh, yes.
Well, there is
lovely
that.
Place.
That's a lovely
place.
Place?
Oh, yeah. Mini. Oh.
And so, yeah, that I could do, that I could definitely do, and maybe, well, you know, I make my own tea. I don't really go out that much for stuff anymore because I've become very much focused on my lifestyle choices. So I have two cats. Not that, you know, it's just that cats wake up very early. And I tend to wake up very early. So now that when I would get up to feed my cats, which is usually about 5:30 in the morning, I'd make myself one of these shakes, one of these health shakes. So it's a prepared shake, but it's, you know, high quality. And I throw in some baby greens, usually kale. I like kale. Mix in the shaky stuff, maybe put a little bit of either almond milk or coconut milk or something nice. Make a nice little shake.
What is it, berry powder or something?
It's not berry, no. It's I think it's chocolate flavor, but I still mix it with green, so it tastes like green chocolate, I guess.
Wow, that okay. Must be an interesting one.
Yeah, so it doesn't really, it's not really dessert tasting because there's not a lot of sugar in it. And chocolate really is very healthy if it doesn't have the sugar and the milk in it. It has a lot of healthy properties.
Well, you just have the cacao, essentially.
Yeah, essentially that's what it is. And so I found that having this shake, it's actually called Shakeology, but having this shake in the morning has been really transforming my I won't say biology, but my habits. My habits. So I've been doing it about a month, I can't really say that I'm losing weight, but I'm losing bloating, you know, so it's like less bloating, less sort of joint issues, less hunger. And so, at least initially, there's less hunger in the sense that I don't have the cravings. So I haven't been drinking coffee. That doesn't satisfy anymore. I don't like sweet snacks anymore, because I used to have coffee and something a little sweet in the morning, even if it's graham crackers. And then I find that my body really just wants real food. And so just by having that balancing factor in the morning, now this isn't like going to a concert or going to a movie, but
it's insulin friendly.
It's
Dr.
very important,
but it's insulin friendly. And so I've seen all of these little bits of transition just by virtue of doing that. So that's been, well, my month really, but my week. And so it's just my whole system seems to be regulating a lot better than it was when I was more addicted to coffee in the morning. And so now I can't even drink coffee in the morning anymore. It makes me nauseous if I try to drink it. So I found that, you know, doing these healthy shakes makes a significant difference in overall health. And so, yeah, so that's been my big thing. And I've been, you know, I always enjoy doing my meditation and Qigong, so I do that. So for me, having big fun is sitting and being quiet for a couple of hours. To me, is the best fun in the world, and not having to interact very much with the chaos. Not so much. I like interacting with people, but I don't like to interact with news and chaos and, you know, anger and frustration. So I find that when I take the time every day to really be at peace, and then limit my exposure to the news, which you can even do on the internet. I don't watch TV, but it comes up on the internet. And to me, that's the best point in the world, is to just be peaceful. So that's kind of my thing, I guess. I don't know if I do it to a fault, but I do put significant energy into being at peace. So that's what my week is about primarily. That's my lifestyle has become very simple, very basic. I don't do a lot of stuff. I don't go out a lot. I don't go to a lot of movies. I don't go to dinners. So I'm kind of live a boring life, but I'm so pleased with it. I love a boring life. It's nice.
That's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, an interesting book I've come across in Bertolt's office. It's called Lighten Up by Deborah Duda. Mm-hmm. And she talks about feeling joy. You know, just to feel joy. And she says, why people don't. It's a very interesting perspective. She says, you may have, as a child, been feeling joy and you were punished for something. So you have in your mind the idea that if you feel joy, you're going to get punished. So it's an interesting way of inspecting your past, I guess, for something like that.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Well, that sounds like a dysfunction, to feel like you're going to get punished for joy, but it's probably a very common one, that people are sort of looking over their shoulder. Even if you don't feel like you're going to get punished, it's almost like you're just waiting for the shoe to drop or something.
Right, right.
So that might be part of it. But I haven't experienced that in a significant... I used to experience that, but now I find that being joyful is a really cool thing. Very, very cool.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, so I just think that's way cool. So I think it's great. I wouldn't mind being joyful all the time. Why not?
Sounds good to me.
I know. I think that some of the problems with that are sort of the not having the self-love, not really being able to embrace self-love. So I think that has something, a little something to do it. Is there a phone? Is that my phone? No. I hear a phone.
I did.
Oh, it's outside. Okay.
From outside.
I also wanted to let people know that there's going to be a very special event here at the Commons, the Brooklyn Commons, which is the first floor on 388 Atlantic Avenue. A different kind of open mic, and it's Saturday, February 18th from 2 to 4 p.m. Sign up starts at 1, and it's an invitation to Dr. Majid Ali's listeners and patients. So for those of you who know Majid Ali, he's
finally
on Saturdays at, I think,
1 o'clock.
But this is an invitation to Dr. Majid Ali's listeners and patients. Dr. Ali is always exhorting us to become our own scientists, to see what works, what doesn't, come up with new ideas, and let him so on. Saturday, February 18th, we are going to flip the script. Dr. Ali will listen as we share with him and with each other what we've learned from his program, books, and videos. Got a new recipe for Dr. Ali's breakfast. How do you attach your castor oil packs? Anybody have a new way to use hydrogen peroxide? How about insulin and oxygen? Do we really understand this message? It's time for us to come together to thank Dr. Ali and his wife, Talat, in person, and let us all be gracious and grateful and giving. So for those of you who listen to Dr. Ali, essentially it is a day of appreciation. Yeah, you could talk about your castor oil packs, but I think what would be great is to talk about how his service and education has made a difference in your life, if you've been able to improve your life, if you appreciated what he's had to offer, if you just like him, you know, if you just like the guy and want to say, you know, you're a pretty cool guy, then this is your opportunity to do that. And so it's, again, an invitation to Dr. Majid Ali's listeners and patients for the open mic so that you can return appreciation to Dr. Majid Ali, Saturday, February 18th, 2017. That's coming up in just a couple of weeks. 2 to 4 p.m. Sign-up starts at 1 p.m., so you want to get there a little bit early. Make sure you have a good seat, because he has a lot of patients and listeners. But, you know, it'll be a wonderful thing. So, and I just think it's really nice to appreciate people while they're around, to be able to appreciate them, because I believe he's in his 70s, so it's, you know, and he's going strong, but let's enjoy life with people and appreciate each other. It's a beautiful thing. This idea was actually created by Melissa, who owns the Commons, as well as the building WBAI is renting at the moment, though we're on the third floor. So please do check out this beautiful event and offer a little bit back to Dr. Majid Ali. And the Commons is a beautiful space. You'll be able to find something nice there to snack on and offer your appreciation to Dr. Majid Ali. And he is the host of Science, Health, and Healing on Saturdays at 1 p.m.
You know, Dr. Ali, you watch his videos and you see the process that he went through. When he talks about, on one of them, how he was a mainstream medical man. He was chief of pathology, I forget where.
In a number of places, I believe.
Right, okay. Mm. And he's talking about one time he was laughing at one of his staff who was using a nutrient to try to treat a condition. So he was just like an ordinary allopathic. And then he talks about in his migraine headaches how he got off of Demerol that he was injecting himself with. And it's just fascinating how he goes through this process to become one of the best integrative physicians around. And talking with him as I burn his DVDs for him and make copies, which you're going to pledge for, of course, and you're going to watch them and never need to see a doctor for the most of the things that the average person goes to a doctor for. You will be able to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. So, very interesting to see this.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing to be able to appreciate someone for all the work that they've done to help people save their lives. And he's a very generous person. That's been my experience. He's a very kind and generous and loving person. So I do honor him and hope that everyone who does will show up and let him know on this day, Saturday, the 18th of February from 2 to 4 p.m. Excellent. And so we're going to play a little bit of music, I think, and then we're going to pick up with Ishmael and try to catch up or at least get through a significant part of that book, because this is our last opportunity to do so in this time slot. So let's find, how about Can't Find My Way Home? Blind Faith. Studio number 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. You're welcome to call in if you have some thoughts or comments before we proceed with our reading of Ishmael. going to share some of the readings with us?
All right. Well, what we're going to try to do, as we're not going to be in this time slot, we're going to try to just fast forward, give some highlights. There's just one point, a few paragraphs before we do that. And so we continue. There is a very special knowledge you must have if you're going to rule the world, Ismail said. I'm sure you realize that. Frankly, I never thought about it. The takers possess this knowledge, of course. At least they imagine they do, and they're very, very proud of it. This is the most fundamental knowledge of all, and it's absolutely indispensable to those who would rule the world. And what do you suppose the takers find when they go among the leavers? I don't know what you mean. They find that the leavers do not have this knowledge. Isn't that remarkable? I don't know. Consider it. The takers have a knowledge that enables them to rule the world, and the leavers lack it. This is what the missionaries found whenever they went among the leavers. They were quite astonished themselves because they had the impression that this knowledge was virtually self-evident. I don't even know what knowledge you're talking about. It's the knowledge that's needed to rule the world. Okay, but specifically, what knowledge is that? You'll learn that from the story. What I'm looking at right now is who has this knowledge. I've told you that the takers have it and the leavers. The takers have it, and that makes sense, doesn't it? The takers are the rulers of the world, aren't they? Yes. And the leavers don't have it. And that too makes sense, doesn't it? I guess so. Now tell me this. Who else would have this knowledge besides the takers? I have no idea. Think mythologically. Okay, the gods would have it. Of course. And that's what my story is about. How the gods acquired the knowledge they needed to rule the world. One day, Ishmael began, the gods were considering the administration of the world in the ordinary way, and one of them said, "Here's a spot I've been thinking about for a while. A wide, pleasant savanna. Let's send a great multitude. Let's send a great multitude of locusts into this land. Then the fire of life will grow prodigiously in them, and in the birds and lizards that will feed on them, and that will be very fine." The others thought about this for a while. Then one said, "It's certainly true. If we send the locusts into this land, the fire of life will blaze in them and in the creatures that feed on them, but at the expense of all the other creatures that live there." The others asked him what his point was, and he went on. "Surely it would be a great crime to deprive all these other creatures of the fire of life so that the locusts and the birds and the lizards can flourish for a time. For the locusts still strip the land, and the deer and the gazelles and the goats and the rabbits will go hungry and die. And with the disappearance of the game, the lions and the wolves and the foxes will soon be dying too, won't they? Won't they curse us and then call us criminals for favoring the locusts and the birds and the lizards over them?" Now the gods had to scratch their heads over this because they'd never looked at matters in this particular light before. But finally one of them said, "I don't see that this presents any great problem. We simply won't do it. We won't raise a multitude of locusts to send into the land. Then things will go on as before, and no one will have reason to curse us." Most of the gods thought this made sense, but one of them disagreed. "Surely this could be as great a crime as the other," he said. "For don't the locusts and the birds and the lizards live in our lands as well as the rest? Is it never to be their time to flourish greatly as others do?" While the gods were debating this point, a fox came out to hunt, and they said, "Let's send the fox a quail for its life." But these words were hardly spoken when one of them said, "Surely it would be a crime to let the fox live at the quail's expense. The quail has its life that we gave it and lives in our lands. It would be infamous to send it into the jaws of the fox." Then another said, "Look here. The quail is stalking a grasshopper. If we don't give the quail to the fox, then the quail will eat the grasshopper. Doesn't the grasshopper have its life that we gave it, and doesn't it live in our lands as truly as the quail? Surely it would be a crime not to give the quail to the fox so that the grasshopper can live." Well, as you can imagine, the gods groaned heavily over this and didn't know what to do. And while they were wrangling over it, spring came, and the snow waters of the mountain began to swell, the streams. And one of them said, "Surely it would be a crime to let these waters flood the land, for countless creatures are bound to be carried off to their deaths." But then another said, "Surely it would be a crime not to let these waters flood the land, for without them, the ponds and the marshes will dry up, and all the creatures that live in them will die." And once more the gods were thrown into confusion. Finally, one of them had what seemed to be a new thought. "It's clear that any action we take will be good for some and evil for others, so let's take no action at all. Then none of the creatures that live in our lands can call us criminals." "Nonsense," another snapped. "If we take no action at all, this will also be good for some and evil for others, won't it? The creatures that live in our lands will say, 'Look, we suffer, and the gods do nothing.'" And while the gods bickered among themselves, the locusts swarmed over the savannah, and the locusts and the birds and the lizards praised the gods, while the game and the predators died cursing the gods. And because the gods had taken no action in the matter, the quail lived, and the fox went hungry to its hole, cursing the gods. And because the quail lived, it ate the grasshopper, and the grasshopper died, cursing the gods. And because in the end, the gods decided to stem the flood of spring waters, the ponds and the marshes dried up, and all the thousands of creatures that lived in them died, cursing the gods. And hearing all these curses, the gods groaned. "We've made the garden a place of terror, and all that live in it here and all that live in it hate us as tyrants and criminals. And they're right to do this, because by action or inaction, we send them good one day and evil the next, without knowing what we should do. The savannah stripped by the locusts rings with curses, and we have no answer to make the fox and the grasshopper curse us because we let the quail live, and we have no answer to make. Surely the whole world must curse the day we made it, for we are criminals who send good and evil by turns, knowing even as we do it that we don't know what ought to be done. Well, the guards were sinking right into the slough of despond when one of them looked up and said, "Say, didn't we make for the garden a certain tree whose fruit is the knowledge of good and evil?" "Yes," cried the others. "Let's find that tree and eat of it and see what this knowledge is." And when the gods had found this tree and had tasted its fruit, their eyes were opened and they said, "Now indeed we have the knowledge we need to tend the garden without becoming criminals and without earning the curses of all who live in our lands." And as they were talking in this way, a lion went out to hunt, and the gods said to themselves, "Today is the lion's day to go hungry, and the deer it would have taken may live another day." And so the lion missed its kill, and as it was returning hungry to its den, it began to curse the gods. But they said, "Be at peace, for we know how to rule the world, and today is your day to go hungry." And the lion was at peace. And the next day the lion went out to hunt, and the gods sent it the deer they had spared the day before. And as the deer felt the lion's jaws on its neck, it began to curse the gods. But they said, "Be at peace, for we know how to rule the world, and today is your day to die, just as yesterday was your day to live." And the deer was at peace. Then the gods said to themselves, "Certainly the knowledge of good and evil is a powerful knowledge, for it enables us to rule the world without becoming criminals. If we had yesterday sent the lion away hungry without this knowledge, then indeed it would have been a crime. And if we had today sent the deer into the lion's jaws without this knowledge, then indeed this too would have been a crime. But this knowledge, we have done both of these things, one seemingly opposed to the other, and have committed no crime." Now it happened that one of the gods was away on an errand when the others were eating at the tree of knowledge, and when he returned and heard what the gods had done in the matter of the lion and the deer, he said, "In doing these things, these two things, you have surely committed a crime in one instance or the other, for these two things are opposed, and one must have been right to do and the other wrong. If it was good for the lion to go hungry on the first day, then it was evil to send it the deer on the second. Or it was good to send it the deer on the second day, then it was evil to send it away hungry on the first." The others nodded and said, "Yes, this is just the way we have reasoned before we ate of this tree of knowledge." "What knowledge of this is this?" the god asked, noticing the tree for the first time. "Taste its fruit," they told him. "Then you'll know exactly what knowledge it is." So the god tasted, and his eyes opened. "Yes, I see," he said. "This is indeed the proper knowledge of the gods. The knowledge of who shall live and who shall die." "Any questions so far?" Ishmael asked. I jumped, startled by this break in the narrative. "No, this is fascinating," Ishmael went on. "The gods saw that Adam was awakening," they said to themselves. "Now here is a creature so like us that he might almost be one of our company. What span of life and what destiny shall we fashion for him?" One of them said, "He is so fair. Let's give him life for the lifetime of this planet." and the days of his childhood, let's care for him as we care for all others in the garden, so that he learns the sweetness of living in our lands. But in adolescence, we will surely begin to realize he's capable of much more than other creatures and will become restless in our care. Shall we then lead him to the other tree in the garden, the tree of life? But another said, to lead Adam like a child to the tree of life before he had even begun to seek it for himself would deprive him of a great undertaking by which he may gain an important wisdom and prove his mettle to himself. As we would give him the care he needs as a child, let's give him the quest he needs as an adolescent. Let's make the quest for the tree of life the occupation of his adolescence. In this way, he'll discover for himself how he may have life for the lifetime of this planet. The others agreed with his plan, but one said, we should take note that this might well be a long and baffling quest for Adam. Youth is important, and after a few thousand years of searching, he might despair of ever finding the tree of life. If this should happen, he might be tempted to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil instead. Nonsense, the others replied. If you know very well that the fruit of this tree nourishes not only the gods, it can no more nourish Adam than the grasses of the oxen. He might take it into his mouth and swallow it, but it would pass through his body without benefit. Surely you don't imagine that he might actually gain our knowledge by eating of this tree? Of course not, the other replied. The danger is not that he would gain our knowledge, but rather that he might imagine that he'd gained it. Having tasted of the fruit of this tree, he might say to himself, I have eaten of the God's own tree of knowledge, and therefore know as well how to rule the world. I may do so as I will do. This is absurd, the gods. And he goes on along this line, and he continues, and later, Ishmael goes into the Asia Minor and the Mediterranean Sea and the Arabian Peninsula and the Semitic War over propaganda. And he goes into the history of the takers and the leavers people. The leavers being the hunter-gatherers, the takers being agriculturalists. And eventually Ishmael dies. And let's see. That guy, this is the guy you visited a couple of weeks ago, trying to locate Rachel Sokolow. Rachel Sokolow was the woman who took Ishmael in as a pet. And it finds out. It wasn't until I got Ishmael's poster to the framing shop that I discovered there were messages on both sides. It had framed so that both can be seen. The message on the one side is the one Ishmael displayed on the wall of his den. With man gone, will there be hope for gorilla? The message on the other side reads, with gorilla gone, will there be hope for man? And that takes it fast forward to the end of this narrative.
Wow. So since you've read the book through and through a couple of times now, seems, So how would you give a synopsis of what the story is really teaching people? You know, we went through the, you know, the leavers and the takers. What is it that you really feel that you've gotten from it?
Well, he talks about the story, and again, it invites self-examination, where you fit in this story, and what you're going to do about it, if anything, or not, and reflecting on how you're living your life, what changes you might want to make, and how it would fit in. Mm-hmm. It's a rough draft, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts overall on what we've heard throughout these weeks about this particular book, Ishmael? Hold up. Yes.
My sense is that it's a very interesting mixture of commentary on really international affairs. You know, how you control resources, whether it's your own or you attempt to control other people's resources, something about human nature, you know, what are the ethics behind how we treat each other,
mm-hmm.
And also how the question of evolution and what evolution really means,
mm-hmm.
I think, is examined in this novel.
Yeah, I found it fascinating through a lot of the readings, and just the perspective from the Ishmael, who's essentially an evolved primate, you know, an animal species, and it kind of made sense to me because I feel that there's real intelligence in animals. They can't really communicate it to us, and I think that they don't have the same kind of intelligence that human beings have, but they seem to just live naturally so much more harmoniously with the natural order of nature, which is what the book is kind of talking about. And so I kind of like that about the book, that it was giving that perspective of how so much of existence lives in harmony with each other, with itself and with each other, and how human beings have fallen into disharmony. And I know that a lot of it is the politics, you know, the leavers and the takers. But I think that the book presents to us a choice. What kind of being do we want to be on the planet? And then as we think about that, it allows us to see how deep it goes in our life, because it's very easy to say that I'm not a taker, but, you know, I think most people really are, you know, on some level, I think a lot of people are, and we have to keep, I feel, making choices to reinforce moving into that state of harmony with the planet, and like you said, working to neutralize the effect of dominance that's imparted on us politically. So that's like, there's two tracks to that. One is whatever political action people choose to take, but also there's the personal part of it in terms of your own personal choices and whether or not you can hold your own resonance. Because I feel that a lot of this domination and control is manifested through fear and fearful situations and people feeling desperate and having to make more and more desperate choices. So I think ultimately to have a humane world, people have to make choices not based on their personal interest and desperation. So that's a difficult thing to do. I mean, you know, we have Donald Trump putting back all these pipelines that are going to be destroying the environment. It's easy for me to say to those people who are going to work there, well, maybe you shouldn't work there. But ultimately, it's a personal choice, and I think that's what it comes down to. You know, even with the violence of some aspects of the police department, law enforcement, ultimately, it's going to take those policemen refusing to do that. I really think that it really, a lot of it does come down to a personal choice. And as long as we have people who are willing to go with the program, for whatever reason, you know, it's my job. I have a family to feed, so I have to do what I have to do. So that's how we got where we are, I believe. I think that the people in control have control because we surrender our sovereignty to them on some level. And so it's twofold. You have to do the activism, but I think we also have to self-examine and decide how we're going to live our lives. I really think so. And then the third component of that is whether or not we can sustain this path without descending into that fearful state. So, okay, so you have a job that you don't like. So you're worried about meeting the rent at the end of the month. These are real conditions. But worrying and fretting over it doesn't really change it. It doesn't contribute anything to it. So I think that if we can begin to challenge that state of being in fear and move more into a state of inner harmony and then finding that intuitive flow, that will allow us to find pathways that are not as destructive. So I think there's a lot of personal responsibility in deciding whether or not you're going to be a lever or a taker.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the effort that's being made through a lot of the mainstream media to instill fear in you and to sort of keep it at a sort of high-pitched level is something that, unless you basically tune it out completely, it's rather difficult to incorporate in your life and just sort of carry on as if everything else is fine. I mean, it's pretty heavy stuff that's mm-hmm. happening right now, and I can't help but remember a time when, I think it was many, many years ago, how I saw how such manipulation played mm-hmm. out right before me. Like I remember at a place I used to work with a lot of people, someone spread a rumor about a mob coming to attack the compound where I worked. Mm-hmm. There was no mob. But that fear got about 800 people to evacuate the whole area. And there was no mob. This was entirely something that was spread as a rumor to frighten people into thinking that something horrible was going to happen. And it was entirely artificial. And so I realized that that's sort of a kind of an exercise and engineering fear. And I think that's what you're getting now from the guy who's currently in the White House.
Well, yes, but I think that's, we've been getting that for the last 30 years, which
True.
Is why we have this guy in the White House.
True.
When you look at, he was able to stir up so much fear and hatred and anger in people. But it's been cultivated over a long period
sure.
of time. And I think that the only real answer to that is for people to stabilize themselves and be able to have a broader perspective. Now granted, not everybody's going to do that, but I do think that's the challenge, to take a step back from fear and ask yourself, what am I really afraid of? So from one of the things that I always ask myself when I'm feeling, because it's an energy, you know, it rises up in you and you don't know necessarily where it's coming from, and you don't know if it's a real flight or fight situation or if it's just anxiety, extreme anxiety. So I usually stop when I get into that state and I look around myself and I said, okay, I'm not on fire. I'm not starving. You know, I'm not in any, I don't perceive any immediate danger. So it's like if I stop myself and just sort of look around and give myself that perspective, then it's sort of like taking a step down the ladder of fear. And then you can begin to say, okay, well, I'm hearing, like you said, hearing these stories. How real are those stories? And even if they are real, am I being impacted by this in this very moment? You know, so it's like you have to sort of pull back from fear, because what happens is that fear takes you out of your capacity to be intuitive about a situation. And so I have found that my greatest ally in potentially dangerous situation is my own intuition. You know, I will cross a street based on intuition, not knowing what I might be walking into on either side of the street, but I'll, you know, I follow an intuition. And there have been many days when I would have been heading someplace. I used to do a lot of training in the park many years ago. And I would go out every morning, go out and train, go out and train. But every once in a while, I would get that intuition, don't do it. And I didn't do it. You know, I just, so you don't know what you're not running into, right? Mm-hmm. If you're following the intuition. But the, like the, and I think a lot of people can see how this works, because I've spoken to a lot of people who had experiences like me when the Twin Towers came down, when the 9/11 happened. A lot of people got an intuitive hit not to go anywhere, to stay where they were, or take a separate route, and not go to work that day. And that's what happened to me. I took off. I worked at night, and I just took off that night. I just couldn't figure out why I didn't want to go to work. I just had the strong feeling, don't do it. Stay home. So I did. And granted, I didn't, you know, I worked uptown, but it was an overnight job. And then I would have been in the subway system when that happened, which would have been hassle. I'm not saying that I would have been hurt, but it would certainly have been a hassle. And who knows, I could have been in the area, been subject to all that dust and mayhem. So I think that if people can begin to realize that they have an expansive intuitive resource, they would be less to fear. And I believe that if we could, as a humanity, as a citizenry, really begin to understand how shallow, truly shallow, the differences of race and ethnicity and religion are. I mean, I know a lot has been made of it, and people have suffered from that, but the truth of it is, there really, it's a very shallow consideration. And so if we could begin to recognize that, then there would be less to fear. You know, so I just think that humanity and each of us individually have to take on more responsibility, because our leaders are not leaders. They're manipulators. And if we wait for that to happen from the level of leadership, we're just going to be, you know, we're on the Titanic. So if we're going to steer this ship in another direction, it's going to take us to do it, humanity. And so that's what the book says to me. It's like you really, on a very deep level, we really have to decide what kind of world we want to have.
Yeah, I agree. And after attending that concert that I described earlier, it dawned on me as I was sitting in the audience that the way that we can kind of become in tune with each other in the way that you're describing, mm-hmm, is through the arts. And the arts are, I guess, one of the few sort of outlets where it really doesn't, I wouldn't say one of the few, but it is an outlet where everyone is welcome. And it you're celebrating whatever it is you're enjoying, whether it's, you know, what you see as a painting, a sculpture, music, dance. It's really celebrating the creativity, the spirit, the soul of the artist, mm-hmm. and that has no color, that has no label. And I think that in terms of resisting or really coming together and saying, you know, watch this because this person's trying to pit us against each other, that it's really in the milieu of the arts that mm-hmm. we're going to have that kind of unity. Or at least it's one of the places that I think that people will find a sense of unity. Mm-hmm. I felt that in the audience. It was the oddest thing. The concert was maybe about 2 hours. But for those 2 hours, I completely forgot about what was going on in the rest of the country.
Well, I agree with you. That's why arts are very important, because it's a significant component of being, you know, creativity and being and community. So I totally agree with that. But that realization needs to travel with us out of the concert hall into our lives,
sure.
into the subway, into the schools, into the workplace. If we could have that kind of energy in our workplaces, we would be fairly healthy about work, I think. It's just that many workplaces make us feel disempowered and enslaved.
Yeah.
Not all.
Yeah, not all.
Certainly I've had employment on both sides of the spectrum. When you're working with people that are excited about what they do and are dedicated to what they do, it's a totally different experience than when you're working like a cog in a wheel in a institution that, you know, is not relating to you on that human level. So it differs. And I think part of the problem is that our society has created, a ruling class has created a situation where people have less and less leisure time. So it's all about forced into survival and stress over survival. So people don't have time to breathe, people don't have time to enjoy each other, to have fun, to grow, to play. And we have to start taking back that space. I feel that even the so-called unions have sold out a lot to the ruling class, because they're, but people, we have to protect each other's rights to have a decent living wage, to be able to have enough time to have a life and not feel like you have to work 10 jobs in order to pay rent, you know. So I realize that we're living in a society that has created this situation by the ruling elite, but hopefully when more people can really recognize this, they can be less successful pitting us against each other, because people are fearful of immigrants because they're afraid they're going to compete with them for their jobs or something, or whatever it is. I don't really understand it, but I do in a way. I understand it, but I don't. We can guard against it by cultivating a sense of compassion and caring for other human beings.
True, very true. And I think also understanding how something comes to be is important also. It's I guess my perspective is also part of the from the view of foreign policy. Because I want to know what drove someone from their home to come here. Like, why? And there are many, many reasons. But I think that part of the understanding and compassion is understanding that aspect of it.
Well, yes, that's true. A level of political astuteness. But that also, for me, there's a level of responsibility. You know, I guess
sure.
It might just come from the perspective of responsibility. I mean, we're in a way preaching to the converted,
yes.
In the sense that, well, yeah, we understand that the bombing of Iraq was a manipulation, you know, in the first instance, because Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. So there's been this whole snowball of aggression in the Middle East that has driven people from their homes. They didn't leave because they wanted to leave. they loved where they were, and they had their communities and their culture, and a lot of them, countries like Iraq was a secular, successful country. A lot of these countries were doing very, very well. But because we, the West, so-called, are drove these wars, wars of aggression, as I see them, you know, over resource control, you know, I'm sure the list is huge, but we still have to find a way to get that message into the awareness of people so that they can put the pieces of it together. These people would not be immigrating here if we weren't bombing their homes.
Of course.
You know, if we weren't funding the terrorists and training terrorist groups, which is part of what the process has been, starting with the first Afghan war between Russia and, what was it, Iraq? You could say.
Yeah, it was a Russian invasion of Afghanistan.
Right. So what happened? So our operatives began to fund the groups in Afghanistan to fight Russia, and then after that war was over, this process continued to escalate. And so, I mean, so it's, you know, so if we could just really look at it all, then if we could find a way to convey this to people, there might be greater understanding. I don't know. But that's what it's going to take. You know, because I feel, as much as I would love to say, you know, to just place blame on the ruling elite, and I feel that they do have the blame for creating this situation, I just don't believe that they have any intention of changing that direction. So for me, it's really coming to some understanding and broadening that perspective is the only way to really change it. So for instance, you know, like with the situation, when I look at what happened in South Africa when it was an apartheid system, the only way that system ended is because people boycotted, people divested.
And on a South global Africans scale. Themselves.
Yeah, so yeah. There was a global divestment of industries that were supporting apartheid. I think that needs that kind of action when we see, you know, when we see these kinds of atrocities taking place. That's what it's going to take. And so, you know, it's difficult because, you know, the poor guy on the street, like you and I, are not really vested in these corporations, but all of the pensions are. You know, it's like people have to pull back and reclaim their power. So, I guess it's just perspective. I think you're right. You know, looking at why they left, that's important. Not hating them for the fact that they're trying to escape. We would be trying to escape too.
Anyone would.
I mean, if you look at the devastation of these bombings, and, you know, and these were like exquisitely beautiful classical cities have been bombed to the ground. Millions of people are being killed, men, women, and children. And so who would not want to escape from that situation?
Exactly.
So, so we need to have a humanity check here. So it's not just the ruling elite. They could not get away with it if people were not buying into it. So there has to be a level of personal responsibility.
Yeah, but that also implies what a person's sense of ethics are. Because if your sense of ethics ends where your bank account begins and your investment...
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. It's a matter of... That's why I was comparing it to, it's a matter of making a choice. And the choice runs very, very deep. You know, what's more important to you? And for a lot of people, maintaining their privilege is the most important thing. So in order to maintain their privilege, they have to demonize everyone who's not privileged, such as they are. So it's easy to say, oh, when a cop shoots a black child in the street, oh, they must have been a criminal. it becomes easy to say when, you know, someone wants to come to be, to find sanctuary, that, oh, they're a terrorist. You know, so people have to take response. I mean, I think that there needs to be an accounting of self-responsibility. So I'm less into blaming the elite than I used to be, because there just needs to be personal responsibility, because I don't see any other choice. I don't see any other choice that, you know, so that holding people accountable, holding our institutions accountable. So, for instance, when there was this really present problem in Standing Rock, you know, with the indigenous people. Well, it's still very present, and it's going to be worse because Trump is giving the final permissions to do that. But from my perspective is that there was a point where the mayors were reaching out to neighboring counties for them to send their police force in to manage the native people, the indigenous people, and the water protectors. And it reached a point when people in these towns reached out to their sheriffs and to their mayors and say, we don't want our police, we don't want our husbands and sons abusing the indigenous people in Standing Rock. And so a lot of those cities refused to send police to engage in that situation. So this is kind of what I'm speaking of. It really needs to be people standing up and saying, we're not going to put up with it. You know, that's the only way. I don't see any other way. Because the elite who are profiting from it have no incentive to do the right thing. And it's really up. I mean, we outnumber by 99%. If 99% of the people say, no, we're not going to destroy the earth, the elite could do nothing about it. There's nothing they could do.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said we still are the majority.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. I'm just feeling, as much as I think we need to have that perspective, because that's how people can make intelligent decisions, I just feel that...
And see through false arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's part of the art of it all.
Yeah.
Or artifice of it all.
And actually, yeah, and I think that this is why, you know, we are going into fund drive next week. Next Monday we're starting a fund drive at WBAI. And I can't imagine people not understanding why it's important for this institution to survive. And, you know, we've been living on the edge for a very long time. And in this era, it's going to be very easy to topple this organization and organizations like it if people don't support it.
Absolutely.
You know, and it needs to expand so that there can be a real media outlet for people to get real information, or at least, you know, counter information, something that's not being forced, spoon-fed them the way the media works. Because it really, you know, the right... the elite and the ultra-right have systematically poisoned people's minds and poisoned people over the last 30, 40 years. Now, I remember, because I was here in the 60s and the 70s, it was a different world. There were more problems, maybe, or equal problems, but human beings were at a point of really seeking liberation and collaboration and cooperation and peace. And again, when the wall came down in in Germany, and when, you know, Russia fell, the communist Russia, you know, there was all these people talking about peace dividends and this and that. But all of that was not permitted to happen because of the choices that were being made by the power brokers. But there's been a systemic, excuse me, programming of people's minds.
Of course.
And so... You know, I think that we have to take responsibility for unraveling that mess, because it's not going to come from Fox and CNN and all those places that are benefiting from that control. Through mind control, through the media.
Yes, and I think I remember when the Soviet Union fell, and I remember saying to my mother, because we have these conversations about politics, and now that I sort of reflect on it, the issue, and I said this to her in simpler language, but there would be an issue. It will be interesting to see what the world is like when it's a unipolar world politically. Mm-hmm. You know, unipolar meaning it basically all is rather than there being more than one hegemon or strong political force. It's basically one, you know, strong hegemon that has its tentacles and everything. So when you had like the U.S. versus Russia or China, you know, it's the, you know, capitalist versus the communist, and they sort of playing off of each other and engineering fear in each other's population, that's one thing. When you then one side disappears, then you have the other side that basically goes and can be kind of predatory. And so I was saying to my mother, you know, it will be quite an interesting world, you know, when one side disappears, because the other side would most likely be very predatory. I wonder if that's part of the motivation or the nature of, you know, the interests involved, that there can be no other power equal or greater than them on an economic basis and in an economic sense or on the level of political clout. And so one of the interviews that I did recently, which was with Bruce Gagnon, brought up the fact that much of the motivation comes from the necessity to avoid having, for instance, Russia and China join together politically or economically. That would create such a huge block that it would dwarf the Americans.
Well, that's already happening.
Yeah, but the thing is that all of this push towards war, the sort of defunding of the social safety nets, the intention to defund Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and invest it in a war to basically get rid of your competition. I think that that's part of what we're seeing. I think that this fear-mongering is just fear-mongering, but at the end of the day, you'll see whether or not you keep your social safety nets in.
Well, I think it's very likely everything that that's being proposed is going to come to fruition. I don't think that there's going to be a safety net. Social. I think that America has been and is continuing to be transformed into what we used to refer to as a banana republic. And I don't think that's going to change. So I guess it's just a matter of perspective. I'm not so much into the analysis as I am into solutions. We have to go, though. So I want to say we're out of time, and I want to say stay tuned to Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. This has been Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight with Catherine Davis, Paulette Spencer, and Matt Mazza. And we are going to sign off with Brian Jackson, Gail Scott-Heron, A Prayer for Everybody, and then I'll Follow the Sun, Beatles for Sale. We'll see how much of that actually plays as we make transition to the next program.
Cool.
So good night, all. And tune in on Mondays at 1 p.m. for the continuation of Heart of Mind.
This is a prayer for everybody in the world. 'Cause I am you and you are me, and we are.
I've gone, for tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Someday you'll know I was the one, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend, in the end you will know. Oh, one day you'll find that I have gone, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend, in the end you will know. Oh, one day you'll find that I have gone. But tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun.
And more stuff. Stop talking, Kathy says, but I'm a BAI person. Jeez. Hello, everybody. Good morning. What's the whole title? Heart of Mind, what? Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight was brought to you live with portions on recording. Unfortunately, Gil Scott-Heron wasn't actually in the studio. If he were, I'd just be getting autographs and bowing and kowtowing. I lived for the revolution will not be televised, which turned out not to be true. But it doesn't matter. His art, his mind, his soul were among the greatest things of the best minds of our generation. And Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight is something that follows that philosophy. And while after the dust settles, and if and when I start at 1 a.m., I have to say that the soul of what that show does is a late night show, in my opinion, as opposed to 1 o'clock show. There's stuff to do at 1 in the afternoon, yeah. But midnight is a better way to find people's hearts and souls, in my opinion. But I am but a leaf in the wind, and I get canceled and renewed, and I earn a half hour, I lose a half hour, whatever. But Wednesday night, it's Robert Knight's time. It has been since the 80s when he first came here. He says because of a premium I was offering, he said that was the first time he came to WBAI. Because I had a premium of a fabulous poster for a Broadway show called Warp. It was done by a comic book artist, and Robert had to have that. So he actually donated $50, which, by the way, in late 1970s money, is a lot of money. It's not nothing today. And I don't remember exactly when Earthwatch began. This is, by the way, approximately the 45th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf. Believe it or not, in the last week or two, because I'm not sure what day it began, but it began in January 1972. Earthwatch 78. So Earthwatch on the air Wednesday nights for 30. That's right. He was outed for really horrific reasons, lack of logical reasons. But, hey, it's not water under the bridge. We're still living with some of the problems. But to me, okay, we don't own time slots. I didn't own Saturday mornings 5 to 7 a.m., even though I was there for 39 years before I was removed from there. But I understand it's not ownership, it's a lease. But for me, there's a thing about what a time slot feels like, what it offers, what it does. And Earthwatch had a very specific feeling that while it wasn't what Hour of the Wolf does, it dovetailed so well, which is why I'm so happy, so easy about Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight, flowing into Hour of the Wolf and all that. Robert and I never gave a bleep about that, because it's about airflow and thought flow and feeling flow. And while I applaud health programming, I really think that there's something about the spirit that Robert and Paulette and Catherine, where did Kathleen come from? Somebody else, never met her. Catherine have been doing through for 31 years, 39 years with time off for good behavior. So I know you're not talking, Paulette, but I just wanted to say that in your presence. Thank you. I think the station and these listeners owe you and Catherine and Robert a lot. That's all. Okay. The rest of it, as I say, I'm a leaf in the wind. But what I am is, I guess, the station's oldest volunteer, having started in 1967. Other people got paid, people before me, like Bob Fass and Janet Coleman. They predate me, but they're the only two. But they got paid for their work at one time or another. I'm just a volunteer. Excuse me, unpaid staff member. So I wanted to share my heartfelt feelings. Thank you. That being said, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial. Oh, God, is it non-commercial? Listener-sponsored radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And you know what? We usually tend to start out with a howl.